C7. The Science of Oneness in the Christian Science Textbook. Number 1A.
Now, this week's work will be on the subject of the science of oneness as presented in the Christian Science Textbook. So, the accent will be on the science of oneness, which would investigate what is the structure of oneness, investigate which aspects of oneness have to be considered in order that oneness is actually oneness in its very nature. So today I want to give first a general introduction into the subject of oneness, and then from tomorrow on, for the rest of the week, I want to go through each chapter of the textbook and showing the differentiated sense of oneness that is found in each chapter, showing that each chapter will bring out another aspect of oneness and not always the same aspect of oneness, so that finally, when we have the whole textbook together, we'll see that we have a very differentiated sense of oneness. So let me first today introduce the whole subject slowly, step by step, and in order that you can organize your notes a little bit better, today I perhaps tell you when I start with a new point so that you can enumerate your points and have some kind of a better overall view of the subject. I start out point one, oneness as the fundamental problem of being. Oneness as the fundamental problem of being. So, let me talk first about this. When we speak about oneness, we at once speak about duality. So, whenever we speak about an aspect of oneness, we have to speak about an aspect of duality. Oneness, duality, was naturally one of the first and is one of the oldest philosophical questions with which mankind has been engaged with. It is such a fundamental question in philosophy that it has always been of great interest to the thinking people all through the thousands of years. If we consider just those two big strains that form Western thought, namely the Bible and the Greek period, we can see that the Bible is actually one great cry to have one God and not to have many gods, that the overall tone of the Bible is that sense of monotheism, let's have only one God, whatever that God then was, but it is a cry to get away from the gods many. That was the biblical aspect that still has its impact on Western thought. On the other side of the Mediterranean, we had the Greek period, the first philosophizing scientists, and they too had the terrific great question of oneness and duality, which they tried to solve. It was always the great question, is there only one kind of substance in the universe? One kind of substance that would underlie everything, so that all phenomena would only be variation of that one substance? And therefore the question, is that one substance matter, or is that one substance spirit or idea, as they may have called it since Plato? Therefore, the great question that was started there and which was has its impact all through the centuries up to now, namely the constant change in the philosophical attitude between materialism and idealism. Every century, so to say, was swinging to one side and then afterwards to another side, and were accentuating perhaps materialism and then again materialism or idealism. And this question actually has never been resolved in a satisfactory way up to now. The philosophizing scientists are still engaged in this question and try to find an answer. So you can see that this week we really are contemplating one of mankind's deepest question and inquiry into the ontological question of what is fundamental. This whole question of oneness can be looked at in a very simplistic way or in a more differentiated way. Let me first talk about the simplistic sense of oneness and the simplistic sense of dualism. I do that because, in general, the Christian Science thought has approached that very fundamental and big question on a very simplistic basis, which is absolutely inadequate. And therefore I want to bring it to the surface to show how they are thinking about this simplistic sense of oneness. It is usually summed up in the statement, God is all. Or let's say, in the sense which says, there is only one being. And it is so that many feel that with such a statement they really state something very deep, that there is only one being, that there is no being without outside that one being, and therefore that all is one. And they feel that this is really deep, deep, deep metaphysics. But today we are aware that such a statement has no information whatsoever, that it is the most superficial statement we can make, the most unscientific statement which can make. I just refer perhaps to Popper, who has brought that out very clearly and shown that such a general statement, which in itself is true, is not a scientific truth, because it carries within itself no exact information. Everyone who reads and makes that statement can interpret that statement the way he likes it to interpret, and therefore has no scientific basis, no scientific structure, no scientific authority. I think we have to awake to that, because it has become so well known in the Christian Science field that if we don't know any answer to any question, if in an argument we don't see eye to eye, that we think we can solve the whole thing just by saying, after all, there is only one being. And think in this way we really find an answer to any argument, not knowing, not realizing that we just add one stupidity to another. It has no information whatsoever, because everyone can understand or can interpret that all the way he likes it, whatever he considers it. And therefore, if we think that this is a deep statement of Christian Science, we forget that long before Christian Science, the mystics have also stated that in unmistakable words, that the inner teaching of the mystics is that all is one and that there is only one being, so that in this way, actually, Christian Science only repeats what the mystics 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago have already stated, and therefore there is nothing new about such a statement. The difference actually is, as I said, that we must see what do we understand when we say that being is one. You see, Christian Science says that all is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation. The mystics would agree to that. They have stated that thousands of years ago. But the statement that they make has a different interpretation. The mystics would not incorporate into that statement or build into that statement a properly stated syllogism, because they do not rely on the classical logic. Therefore, they will not accept a classical syllogism. Therefore, if we would put their concept of the oneness of being into a syllogism of Christian Science, it would read that they too say all is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation as the major proposition. Then as a minor proposition, they would say that all material things and experiences are manifestations. So you would have a general proposition, a major proposition and a minor proposition. And then naturally the conclusion would be, and that's the conclusion really of most mystical teaching, that material things, that would be the conclusion, that material things are the manifestation of mind. And there we would have the wrong conclusion when looked at from the standpoint of Christian Science. For them, naturally, therefore, matter is a manifestation of mind. So you can see, if we only have a statement that all is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation as a major proposition, and do not state the minor proposition rightly, but also in Christian Science we could arrive at wrong conclusions, just as the mystics. Therefore, a statement like all is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation by itself really does not yet show the scientific sense of oneness. It only brings out the simplistic sense of oneness, the undifferentiated sense of oneness, and as long as it is an undifferentiated sense of oneness, it lends itself always to misinterpretation. The same thing is true about the simplistic sense of dualism. This simplistic sense of dualism we have mostly in the discussion among Christian Scientists. Why? The textbook says very clearly that we must draw a line of demarcation between, and then comes between. Now, it states the dualistic sense between opposites, like between spirit, matter, life, death, truth, error, good, evil. It is showing clearly that there are opposites. The whole textbook is full of terms of opposites, antidotes, antipodes, contraries. The reasoning on the level of Christian Science demands that line of demarcation so that we do not mix up spirit and matter, truth and error, that we don't mix up the opposites. Therefore, also in Christian Science, we are asked really to become aware of these opposites, and we study the synonymous terms not only through the ideas which characterize the synonymous terms, but also we study what are the exact counterfeits of the seven synonymous terms, so as to bring out the contraries, the opposites, therefore to be very clear what are facts and counterfeits, thereby making a clear distinction between the two. And the moment we make a clear distinction between two, the danger is that we build up a dualistic consciousness, where we constantly have two opposites. And one of the critics one hears very much against Christian scientists, perhaps not so much against Christian science as Christian scientists, that they are great dualists, that they constantly have an opposing factor, that they constantly fight against something, that they constantly are faced with an opposite, and therefore build up a sense that there are two realities at work, that there are two entities to be accounted for, and which builds up slowly and slowly over the years within the Christian scientist the sense there are two kinds of universes, the universe of truth and the universe of error, and we jolly well have to raise in the strength of all our understanding to stand against error. The moment you have against, you have a dualistic sense. So that one really becomes hard-boiled dualists, constantly having a foe, constantly having an accuser, constantly having a claim which you have to reject and to overcome, not seeing, as what we have seen last year in the logic of Christian science, not seeing that actually this line of demarcation does not draw a line between two facts, but between a fact and a counterfeit. It's actually making a line of demarcation between two concepts and not between two realities. So that actually in Christian science we would have not a dualistic logic, a two-valued logic, but actually a two conceptual logic, two concepts that are opposed to each other. But they are only concepts, they are not facts. So, can you see that in this way we have usually to deal with a simplistic sense of oneness, which just says all is one and there is only one and there is only one God, there is only one being and there is no other being besides that one being. On the other hand, like a contradiction, we usually have a very simplistic sense of dualism, namely just always have opposites. The answer to it must be that we find a differentiated answer both to oneness and to dualism. We will spend the whole week on finding such a differentiated answer of what is oneness and a differentiated answer as to what seems to be dualism. So can you see we have a very contradictory proposition where on one side we see that there is a sharp distinction between opposites, and on the other side we see that there is only one. Now how can one reconcile such two different attitudes in a teaching like Christian science? That on one side there is that cry just for the one, and that there is only one, and then the text is full of opposites. This must be solved and resolved in an intelligent way, and therefore we must ask for a solution. If we want to find a solution, then it must be really a differentiated answer to oneness and to dualism, a differentiated answer that does not go out just from saying there is the one, and that one is an infinite one, and that infinite one must therefore be, and there comes in the differentiation, an infinitely differentiated oneness. If we say it is an infinite one, we don't say there is a one-one. There is an infinitely differentiated one. Now, as I have said, this question is an age-old question. It's perhaps the most fundamental question of mankind, perhaps one of the first questions of mankind, how to solve dualism, how to have only one being. So I want to go quickly through the historical development of the sense of oneness as we have it in the Bible. So, point two, I touch now on the development of monotheism. The development of monotheism. It is said that monotheism is, so to say, the central point of all higher religions. That all higher religions are monotheistic. What does monotheism mean quickly? Mono comes from the Greek, meaning one, or single, or alone. Theo means God, so mono, theo, one God, a single God. And naturally, theism is the belief in the existence of a God or of gods. It's the teaching that there is only one God. So monotheism is the belief in the existence of one God only. The thesis that there is only one God. But we have to investigate if this is only a statement, or if actually the inner meaning of what they say is monotheistic or not. And we'll see very soon that this statement is not at all so monistic as we think it is. That therefore the concept of monotheism was not pure right from the beginning. That it needed a long development in order to arrive at the present sense of pure monotheism. Because just the statement as they had it in all the big religions that there is only one God does not yet explain the inner nature of that one God. If that one God was good or evil or both, that one God was spiritual or material or both, all this has not been explained right from the beginning. And therefore, we must see and investigate what was the inner nature of that monotheistic God. Was God a spiritual creator and his creation material? Still, that would have been a monotheistic concept in the Old Testament. And so we want to investigate that quickly by running through the Bible. I do that not because we should know the history of something, but I feel, in a way, each one, everyone, somehow goes through the history of the spiritual history of mankind. That each individual has a development a spiritual development, and in that spiritual development, perhaps within a few years or within perhaps a few decades, actually evolves and in the line that spiritual history over thousands of years have evolved. And therefore, each one at some time, in some way, has to resolve the errors of the time past. And if we know the history, the spiritual history, we can much easier handle our spiritual development and can much better point our fingers to that problem which needs to be solved and how it should be solved. So I want to consider now the development of the idea of monotheism by going through the Bible and consider the four sides of word, Christ, Christianity, and science as it has developed through the Bible. So I start first with the Old Testament, therefore the first side of the city, the Word, how at the beginning of the Old Testament, the God, as the Word of God, was first brought out in the way of being the one God. In the whole, one can see that the beginning of the Old Testament up to the prophetic age or to the kingdom of prophetic age was actually a great struggle for monotheism. Thou shalt have no other gods before me, was the cry of Moses. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Is that monotheism or not? The asking that there should be only one God for Israel and not many gods? Well, we know that this is not really pure monotheism. It was only asking that Israel should only have one God and not many gods. But they were quite happy to know that the countries around Israel, that the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Scythians, and so on, had their gods. They didn't say those gods don't exist. All what Moses wanted Israel to do is that they, Israel, would only have one God and not the other gods beside that one God. So you can see it was a limited sense of monotheism.